You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, at least one U.S. senator is calling for American military intervention in Venezuela. Coming up, we'll discuss the latest on what's happening there and how the U.S. has been involved militarily and otherwise with previous Latin American conflicts. Now, the part of the country we live in here is often described by those looking in from the outside as insular, provincial, simple, maybe unsophisticated, even worse, flyover country. Our next guest spent her life on both coasts before taking a job teaching at a university in what is often referred to as the heartland. And she quickly realized that the assumptions and expectations that she brought with her didn't match up to the reality or history of her new home. Kristen Hogenson is professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her most recent book is called The Heartland and American History. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, it is such a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, this idea of the heartland and heartland values, when you start to think about it, it's hard to pin down. And it turns out, looking at your book, that's probably because people have meant a lot of different things by it over the years. Could you try to get a handle on it for us?
Right. So the heartland, I think, is often understood through the lens of stereotype and myth. And the leading assumptions that characterize the heartland myth about what the center of the country is like hold that it is profoundly local. And I'm speaking specifically of the rural heartland, which is seen as the, you know, the core of the stereotypical heartland, that is profoundly local, insular, isolated, provincial, and indeed as a place that can be regarded as the ultimate national safe space. So I tackled those ideas in my book and, in fact, end up turning them quite inside out.
Right. The whole book, you're kind of looking from your backyard, basically, in your part of Illinois, and looking at a history that is really not static or isolated or insular. We'll dig into some of the details, but, I mean, in a lot of ways, what we call the heartland is really a crossroads of global activity.
Right. So instead of seeing it as being in the middle of nowhere, I think people on the ground know quite well that it is in many respects in the middle of everywhere, that being in the middle of a major landmass hasn't cut it off from the rest of the world. And in fact, if you look at things like borderlands histories between the U.S. and Canada and U.S. and Mexico, if you try to get a handle on where borderlands peter out, one of the places where you can look is in the Midwest, where they actually have come together historically, and people in the middle of the country have border brokers brokered borders, north and south simultaneously due to their position in the middle.
And a lot of times we hear today and in the past the idea that especially that small town part of the Midwest, what people think of as, you know, Main Street, real America gets thrown around, heartland also does, as this place, it's been the same for a long time. And only now, whenever the now is that we're talking about, is it encountering this change. It's getting roped into the world for better or worse, depending on who you're talking to. But it's always been like that. We've always been at that that intersection between what we think is the static, what we have here, and this changing world.
Exactly. So that is a major point of the book. So it is a history account, and the time period that I cover starts in the early 19th century and goes through World War I. Which is typically thought of as a profoundly local time, that it's the years between what are widely recognized is years of profound contact, which by which I'm referring to the colonial era, and then the 20th century rise of U.S. global power post-World War I, and the recognition that the United States has been deeply intertwined with the world as a whole since the mid-20th century. So I look at the time that's typically considered to be the most local time in U.S. history. And one of the places that is generally conceived of as the most local places. And I find that even if you stretch back and do the long backstory of the modern Midwest, it has always been shaped by histories of mobility and connection. So, for example, if you start with the indigenous people who lived in central Illinois, which is the place I take as the starting point of my story, they were highly mobile over long periods of time and also seasonally, staying in villages in the warmer months to plant and then in the colder months traveling quite widely. And then subsequently, when the settler colonists or pioneers settled the state, they were people who by definition came from somewhere else. You know, that is the meaning of pioneer, somebody who is a newcomer. And they continue to travel quite widely for business, to relocate to other places, in many cases further west, to serve in the military. The Midwest has historically been a hotbed of missionary production, so vast kind of global networks through missionary activities. And in terms of just, you know, the economy of the rural Midwest, for many years, the bedrock of the economy was agricultural. It still continues to be very important in the Midwest. And export markets have always been profoundly important to farmers. From the beginning, they had absolutely no intention of being self-sufficient. They were always ambitious for global markets and were an aggressive foreign policy constituency for expansionist policies starting in the 19th century.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson. Her most recent book is The Heartland and American History. Kristen, I want to dig into each of those time periods a little deeper. You were talking about the Kickapoo who were here and the settlers. And people think of native removal. They might think of the Trail of Tears further south. You say the Midwest, tragically, was the frontier where that happened for many years, decades.
Yeah, so as somebody who teaches the U.S. History Survey and has used a number of textbooks over the year, the core story is the Cherokee story and the horrific story of the Trail of Tears. And I think it's very important that we all know that story, but it's also important that we recognize that it's not the only story and that the Midwest has its own horrific and heart-wrenching stories of Indian removal. Histories of ethnic cleansing, in essence, that predate and then continued alongside the histories that are more familiar to us from the Southeast. And let me just tell you a little bit more about the Kickapoo history, in part because Kickapoos did have a tribal presence in Wisconsin as well as Illinois. That at the time of Columbus, most Kickapoos lived in what is now the Detroit, Michigan, and Windsor, Ontario area. But because of the violence that followed from the fur trade, they, in many cases, relocated further south in Michigan, further west. They went to Indiana, to Illinois, to Wisconsin. And then upon being forced out of the states where they had relocated, upon being forced out in the early 19th century, many went further to the southwest, including to Mexico, where they established a tribal presence. And indeed, there are, to this day, Kickapoo people living in Mexico, as well as in the Eagle Pass, Texas area, who are, in essence, exiled Midwesterners by virtue of their ancestry and family connections.
And then bring it to the next part of the, to another part of the story you were talking about. I mean, today, probably literally today in Wisconsin, we have farmers, dairy farmers often talking about tariffs and how they're affecting them, how much access they're going to have to sell their goods in other countries, Canada, Europe, you name it. You write, people were having exactly that conversation in the late 1800s, 1930s, you name it. This has been a long running concern.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's something that often gets lost in outside conversations about the Midwest. I think that the Midwest is often perceived by people on the coast as an undifferentiated region. And a lot of attention is paid to the deindustrialized Midwest and the job losses and wall building impulses that emanate from places that have lost good jobs to offshore production and to imports from other parts of the world. And I think in those discussions, the real significant global trade connections of the agricultural sector disappear from wider public conversations. But of course, people who are agricultural producers in the Midwest know very well how important export markets have been and how important initiatives such as NAFTA and trade agreements have been for gaining greater markets, and just how painful some of the recent trade war impacts have been.
And another interesting story you tell is how American pigs were not in favor in the British Empire, and it was a key turning point in our economy when I think it was the British Navy finally said, you know, these pork products, they're okay for our sailors.
Yeah, I just love this story. It was so unexpected when I stumbled across the history of the Berkshire pig. I could go on, actually, for hours and hours about it, but I know I don't have that much time. But the point is the pioneers brought pigs with them, but they were nasty, savage animals that could survive on their own in the woods, fend for themselves, jump over fences and so forth. And they weren't very profitable. And the farmers of the Midwest wanted to reach more lucrative markets. For a while, they just relied on river routes to ship their pork products downstream. But that meant feeding the low-end markets of the plantation south in the Caribbean. And what they really wanted were the high-end, lucrative markets of Europe. And they realized that to access them, they had to have a better pork product. And that led them to invest in blooded lines of pigs. And the most popular pig for a while in the 19th century was the Berkshire hog. And as you mentioned, part of his ancestry came from the ships of empire, from the British Navy, brought back to England, to Berkshire County, where they were crossbred with English pigs and produced this just unprecedented kind of a line of hogs that matured early, marbled nicely, fattened quickly. And it became all the rage in the United States, enabling farmers to produce a more competitive pork product, which then they were able to sell to the lucrative markets of Europe, primarily to Britain. And then the meat from the British ancestry pigs ended up feeding the British military, feeding British emigrants to places like New Zealand and Australia on those long-distance trips, and producing more emigration because British farmers were outcompeted and many of them ended up becoming settler colonists, moving to places like Canada, the United States, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson about her latest book. It's called The Heartland, an American History. She's a professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She looks at what is thought of often as isolated, small town, middle America, and she traces over time its incredible connections to the global economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does the term heartland mean to you when we're talking about the United States? Is it all positive? Are there some negative aspects as well? Do you think that people from outside the Midwest get a lot wrong about our region if they think of us as backwards, disconnected? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Kristen Hoganson, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about her latest book. It's called The Heartland in American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in the Midwest all your life, or did you move here? Did you find things that changed your expectations about what it meant to be in the Midwest, especially in the smaller town parts of the state or the region? What do you find that people get right or wrong about the Midwest? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if you've got a family history that goes back five, six generations, whatever the case may be, what have you seen change in your family? What have you seen stay the same over the generations? Call 800-642-1234. We'll bring out a caller now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Mark?
Well, first of all, I'd like to point out that I am also a University of Illinois graduate. But just last night, I was reading an article. We're talking about transplanting people. I was reading an article where during the Depression, they took farmers from northern Wisconsin, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, Minnesota, those who were used to the cold weather, and they were transplanted to help settle Alaska in the area of now Portage, which is just north of Anchorage. And my wife and I are planning a trip there this summer. And in the process of researching that trip, I discovered that. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Interesting. You might find a community of former Wisconsinites there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us. Do you see that the Kickapoo you mentioned, Kristen, moved into the area and were forced back out of the area? Do we see European immigrants coming in and then staging from the Midwest to other parts of the country, as Mark said, to Alaska in that case?
Yeah, so that fits into a much longer pattern. So what tended to happen with a number of pioneers is they had a lot of children. And as land became more expensive, it became difficult for every child to get a farm that would be sufficient to have, you know, a good standard of living. And so they became a really active group of people looking to colonize places further west in places like Indian territory, think Oklahoma. and also in Canada. So there were a number of advertisements in Midwestern newspapers for land seekers excursions to places like Saskatchewan and Manitoba and Alberta. So there is a long history of Midwesterners moving even farther afield over the course of the long 19th century.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. He mentioned seeing old news articles about this, Kristen. That's one of the things I love about your book. You included just a lot of the archival things you ran across, some directly relevant to what you're talking about, some just interesting points of history in the Champaign area of Illinois. Can you talk about hunting and finding some of those?
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned the archival traces. So this book could have been thousands of pages long. I mean, there were just so many leads that I did not have a chance to track down, and it was really hard to let go of them. So I have at the start of each chapter just a couple little snippets from different sources that are just really suggestive about things like monarch butterflies or selling exotic birds door to door that have stories behind them, but I just didn't have a chance to fully pursue the stories. A lot of my research was in local history archives. I also benefited profoundly from recent digitization efforts to take small-scale local newspapers and make them available electronically, which meant that I could keyword search for things. And then I got hits that I never would have found if I had just spent years and years and years going through microfilm reels page by page. So one of the things that I researched was the idea of flyover states, and I was interested in what that meant, right, to be on the ground looking up at the sky and thinking about, aerial connections. And so that led me to things like tracking down bird migrations, which were very important to farmers who relied on birds for pest control before synthetic pesticides. And I'm typing in all these words about birds and sky and so forth, and I start getting all these hits for UFOs, which I never would have found otherwise. And it's because long-distance balloon races in the early 19th century tended to take off from the Midwest, and that's because the balloonists didn't want to go down over water.
Fair.
And so then people living in small towns in the middle of the night would see lights in the sky and hear noises overhead and report UFOs that then made it into the newspapers as, these flying spaceships in the night.
We're talking to Kristen Hoganson about her new book, The Heartland in American History. I want to bring on another caller now. Phil is with us in Appleton. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
What'd you want to bring up, Phil?
Well, I just want to tell Kristen I lived about most of my life about 12 miles south of the University of Illinois, down at the base of the Glacial Moraine, just a little bit northwest of Longview. And his drain swamp, my grandpa helped drain it, and I've been a nature observer all my life because there wasn't any telephone in there when I was a youngster, and it was pretty basic, so I've got a lot of nice things to share with her. Can't do it on the show. I'll do some other time.
Oh, that would be great.
Phil, thanks a lot for the call. He mentioned draining the swamp. Can you talk a little bit about how dramatically the landscape changed, maybe from one period to another, in a region like your part of the heartland there?
Oh, right. So that was another astounding thing I discovered. The wet prairie was called the wet prairie for a reason. It was really, really, really wet. And the part of the state that I live in and take as a starting point for my story was basically swamp until the pioneers came. And then they needed to separate land from water to be able to plant things like corn. And so they embarked on major engineering works. In which they dug ditches, and then they laid tiles beneath the soil that fast-tracked the water into the ditches and then ultimately to the Mississippi and down to the Gulf of Mexico. They laid millions of tiles in Illinois, enough to circle the earth six times if laid end-to-end. So we're talking about some of the most significant engineering works in U.S. history that most people don't know about because they're not visible from, say, the sky if you're in an airplane looking down at flyover state, or indeed if you're just driving across the landscape or the countryside, they're not visible to the eye. But nonetheless, they're there and have massively transformed the ecology of the region, turning it into one of the richest sites of agricultural production in the world today.
That's a fine point to maybe just spend a couple minutes on to hammer home the point you're making. We associate farmland scenery with Wisconsin and Illinois and our neighboring states. It feels natural in a way, But this thing we take for granted was the consequence of, as you said, one of the biggest engineering projects in the country. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, to go beyond engineering, it's bigger than that, right? We're talking about a history of massive biological transformation. So I live in the prairie state, or the so-called prairie state, and yet less than 0.1% of Illinois is native tall grass prairie now. And that is only in part because of urbanization, that most of it is because of the purposeful introduction of new biological material. And we can see that now on massive scales. If you're looking down from the sky in the fields of soy, which was a product first introduced in the early years of the 20th century. But it also exists on a microscopic level, that scientific agriculturalists purposefully introduced bacteria strains from Germany in the early years of the 20th century that had the capacity to fix nitrogen in the soil. And you can't see the bacteria, but it's there in the ground. And if I look out my kitchen window into the backyard, I have an apple tree. So this tree is the descendant of trees that were imported, again, in the late 19th century. Apples are not indigenous to the Americas, and the late 19th century varieties were thought to be better than the earlier colonial ones. And many of the bees that pollinate that tree are also the descendants of late 19th and early 20th century immigrants. The most popular imported bees were Italian bees. That were characterized by a golden color, and they were thought to be superior to the native bees, which were described as dull black-colored bees that were more obstreperous and worse honey producers. So on all kinds of levels, we're talking about massive ecological transformations across the region.
Well, that's all the time we have for now. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us and sharing us some of the stories from your book.
Oh, Rob, thank you so much for having me.
That's Kristen Hogenson, professor of history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She joins us to talk about her most recent book, The Heartland and American History. A U.S. senator is calling for American military intervention in Venezuela. Republican Rick Scott of Florida said this week that he wants the military at the Venezuelan border to remove barriers put up by President Nicolas Maduro so that humanitarian aid can get through. He also wants the military to deliver that aid. Scott's comments mark some of the strongest language used by a U.S. official about Venezuela. Others, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, have called for the Venezuelan military to overthrow Maduro and have expressed support for opposition leader Juan Guaido. Here's Pompeo on Fox Business Network yesterday.
We'd prefer a peaceful transition of government there, where Maduro leaves and a new election is held. But the president has made clear, in the event that there comes a moment, and we'll all have to make decisions about when that moment is, and the president will ultimately have to make that decision, he's prepared to do that if that's what's required.
The U.S. has a long history of getting involved in Central American affairs dating back to the mid-1800s. So why does America feel such a vested interest in Latin America, and are there lessons from the past that could apply today? Eduardo Gamarra is a professor of political science and founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. Eduardo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be with you.
Well, before we dig into that history, Eduardo, let's look at some of the events of this week. Juan Guaido this week calling for a military uprising, encouraging his supporters to force Maduro out of power, a prominent political opponent of Maduro out of prison suddenly, now an arrest warrant out for him. What is your read on the latest there right now?
Well, the situation is so fluid that, in fact, I think it's sort of risky to make any kind of prediction or even any kind of assessment of what's going on the ground. It looks like the government of Nicolás Maduro, to a certain extent, has at least managed to survive this week and has done so with the support of key sectors of the military. In fact, I think one of the things that we can readily conclude is that Guaido's effort to essentially draw the military into his ranks has fallen far short of its objectives, and not as many military people moved into his camp. And so Maduro still controls the bulk of the military and therefore controls the repressive apparatus of the Venezuelan state. At the same time, I think it's important to note that that Guaido has managed to exert some significant amount of support on the streets. And for now, for 3 days running, people are on the street and people are demonstrating and people are obviously demanding an end to the Maduro government. So the situation is very fluid, and I think it's very risky to predict an outcome in the next in the next few days,
sure,
even weeks or months.
Now let's turn to the U.S. role. So far, what has the American government done when it comes to, as you say, this very fluid situation in Venezuela?
Well, you know, it's also difficult to understand what the U.S. has actually done. It's very clear that the U.S. has taken a position, a bipartisan position, of supporting Mr. Guaido, and that the administration, especially the State Department, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, and so on, and Treasury, have been key in imposing sanctions on individuals and have also been important in at least articulating a position that all options are on the table. But in terms of, for example, concrete assistance, whether it's funding, whether it's military assistance of any kind to Guaido and his followers, nothing is really obvious. And it seems obviously that that one of the things that Guaido needs above anything else is access to funds to be able to keep his movement going. At the same time, I think that the U.S., some U.S. officials are, and I'll use the word very cautiously, I think are irresponsibly calling for military intervention, especially given the fluidity of the situation.
Talking to Eduardo Gamarra from Florida International University, looking at the latest events in Venezuela, the U.S. role there, and a look at the U.S. history in Central and South America. Eduardo, the United States from the mid-1800s or so, for a long period of time, intervened economically, militarily, in a lot of ways in various countries in Central and South America. Big picture, we don't have time to get into all the specifics, but big picture, can you talk about the American role and how it's affected that region?
Well, you know, I think we don't have to go back to the 1800s. I think the most immediate recollection is the U.S. support for military governments, particularly military governments on the right, especially governments, for example, like General Pinochet in Chile, General Banzer in Bolivia, the Argentine military juntas and so on, that were plagued with gross human rights violations. So that's the most immediate memory. But I think we're talking about a very different epoch, and we're talking now, in fact, of a rather strange situation, because we have a government that's on the right supporting Mr. Guaido, who's a social democrat on the ground, right? And in fact, I was listening to a senator from Alabama questioning, you know, why are we supporting a socialist, and how do we know that he's not going to become a dictator, right? So I think the situation is different. But yet at the same time, what I said earlier, intervening militarily in Venezuela in any way is not going to bring about immediate change, and it's likely to lead to a protracted conflict. Venezuela is not Panama, as we invaded Panama in 1989. It's not Grenada, as we invaded Grenada in 1983. These are very different circumstances. This is a very different country. And you have the direct involvement of Russia and China, which make things even dramatically different.
Talk about that involvement from Russia and China. What are we seeing there?
Well, again, it's also quite interesting. A lot of people are going back to the Cold War and saying this is the Cold War all over again. But Russia is a capitalist country, and Russia has enormous economic interests in Venezuela, and it's had them at least for two decades, especially in the oil industry. Russia essentially owns the oil industry in Venezuela, and that's saying a lot. Venezuela still holds the world's largest oil reserves. Really, it has oil reserves spanning 300 years. So Rosneft, this private corporation that counts on the support of the Russian government, is extraordinarily important. And so dealing with Russia is no longer dealing with it in an ideological sense, but in a business sense. And at the same time, what you have with the Chinese are very, very invested in Venezuela, and Venezuela has an enormous debt to China, which is paying off, by the way, through the production of oil. And the production of oil in Venezuela has dropped to about 800,000 barrels a day, which is really peanuts in comparison to what it has the capacity to produce. So the interests that you have there are not those traditional ideological interests. They're now fundamentally capitalist interests. And I think if the U.S. doesn't, from a policy perspective, if we try to keep framing this in Cold War terms, I think you have to understand the nature of the problem.
Is there a suspicion in a country like Venezuela and the surrounding region of any American involvement, just given some of that history that we've talked about of past invasions?
Well, to my knowledge, we used to have a very significant military relationship with Venezuela in the 90s. Venezuela was one of the only democracies in Latin America which had F-15s, and was readily supplied with replacement tools and so on. But since 2007, the Russians have become Venezuela's primary military ally. Most of the military equipment in Venezuela today is Russian, and therefore that relationship that the U.S. used to have with the Venezuelan military has been gone for at least two decades. And the U.S. though has been on the crossing the border into Colombia, the United States has been an extraordinary military ally of Colombia, both through the Plan Colombia in the late 1990s and throughout the 2000s. But really, in terms of the training of the military there, the training of the police and so on, in the fight against drug trafficking and in the fight against organized crime.
We're talking about the U.S., Latin America, and the latest events in Venezuela with Eduardo Gamarra, professor of political science and founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, should the United States be doing when it comes to Venezuela? The idea of military intervention has been floated by some officials. Do you think that would be a good idea, or do you share our guests' serious concerns about it? Do you think America has been too involved with Central American conflicts over the last century, or have our actions been appropriate? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about U.S. involvement in Latin America with Eduardo Gamarra and the latest news in Venezuela. He's a professor of political science and the founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Big picture, has American intervention in Central America and South America generally been good or bad for the region and American interests? How, if at all, should the U.S. get involved with Venezuela, or should we stay out? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to a caller now. Stevenson is with us in Wauwatosa. Stevenson, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting program. I think there's a bigger picture, as you gentlemen said, to look at that, because the U.S. presence in the Caribbean has some lack of presence in the Caribbean is also becoming an issue, because Venezuela went to this ALBA program, and then they have some of the smaller states, who's struggling with the economy, and then giving them oil and all kind of thing going on with them. And I can specifically talk about the island of Dominica, where during the invasion of Grenada, like Dominica's Prime Minister then Eugenia Charles actually came and talked and gave the U.S. President then, Reagan, they're okay to go into Grenada, and she has always stands for democracy. Now, you have a situation where the Prime Minister of Dominica, Rosbaud Skerrit, is following the very same footsteps of Chavez and Maduro. An election is coming up soon in that island, and the way that it is doing kind of manipulating people and buying votes and all this kind of thing, I think the U.S. needs to be aware of that, because we are a political party, the Dominica Freedom Party, which has a great relationship with the Republican Party of the United States.
Stevenson, I'm going to jump in. So worries about how U.S. action in Venezuela could affect other countries in the Caribbean, Eduardo.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what he was what his question was going to be, but I think the reality is that over the course of the last two decades, Venezuela developed some very, very significant ties with the Caribbean, with countries that were both on the right and on the left, and especially small island nations like Dominica, like St. Kitts and Nevis, and so on, and but also countries like Jamaica, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and small countries in Central America, largely through a program called Petrocaribe, which was essentially giving oil at a very, very low price, and in fact, allowing these countries to convert the oil into cash. Giving, for example, Cuba especially some extraordinarily significant amounts of cash over the years, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, at least for Haiti to the tune of $2 billion, the Dominican Republic $4 billion, and the numbers on Cuba range as high as $16 billion and so on. But the reality is that relationship, given the mismanagement of the Venezuelan economy, given the collapse of the Venezuelan economy, which the IMF says today has 10,000,000% hyperinflation, those alliances have collapsed. And those countries are now, with a couple of exceptions, right? Those countries are, in fact, supporting the U.S. position and the position of the Lima Group, which is the group of countries that has essentially broken off relations with Maduro and is supporting Guaido. So the Caribbean is also in flux, but largely it's in flux because Petrocaribe is gone, that very strategic relationship that garnered many friends for Maduro and for Chavez before him. That relationship is gone.
Thanks for that call, Stevenson. We'll go now to Nathan in Madison. Nathan, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, sir. I was just calling to just ask a quick question to the guest. This situation is very dear to me. My wife's from Venezuela, and we have family down in Venezuela. And unfortunately, the locals in, you know, from Caracas to Ciudad Bolivar on the Brazilian border, they actually are hoping for some type of help from the United States from a military standpoint, because the violence and the repression is daily. The blackouts and the water shortages are intermittent. And without any type of international assistance, it'd be preferable to have a coalition, obviously, of various allies in the neighborhood, you know, Lima Group, all the members of South America. But without the impetus of the United States, I just don't see anything happening in Venezuela to be the next Cuba.
Nathan, thanks for the call. Nathan saying family members in Venezuela, he's hearing them being hopeful for some kind of U.S. intervention.
Yes, let me. You know, I feel for Nathan. I have close family, close friends in Venezuela, and the reality is that the situation in Venezuela is really. I don't think that any country, including Haiti, has gone through a situation like this, and it's inexplicable given the fact that Venezuela is the wealthiest country in this hemisphere. Given its oil wealth. So as I said before, the reason why Venezuela is in the condition it's in today is because of the mismanagement and the incredible corruption that the government of first Chavez and now Maduro have gone through. And, you know, the fact that they didn't invest in critical infrastructure like the electrical system, you know, it collapsed, and it has been collapsed now for over a month. And people, for example, in cities like Maracaibo, one of the wealthiest cities, in fact, that's where the oil comes from. You know, they have energy, electric energy, 1 or 2 hours a day because the government hasn't been able to restore energy. And when you don't have electricity, of course, it affects all of your other public utilities as well. So the situation is absolutely dramatic. Add to that the fact that there was already no supermarkets that would, you know, that available, medication, hospitals. So it really is a very dramatic situation that has led now to anywhere between 4 and 5 million people leaving Venezuela since 2016. And they're all over the place. They're at least in 72 countries that we've been able to document. And, of course, they've come to the United States. And they have no ability to those who are outside have no ability other than through remittances to help those inside. So it is a dramatic situation. Nathan, I hope your family is fine. But, you know, the reality is that that this is going to go on for a while, and it's likely to get worse for your friends and family there.
Nathan, thanks for the call. We're talking to Eduardo Gamarra from Florida International University about the latest in Venezuela. Eduardo, how, given all the economic disruption, all the problems you're talking about, how does Maduro keep the loyalty of the leaders of the military?
Well, that's a very, very important question, and it's one that from the perspective really of Washington is often hard to figure out. One would expect that, given what I just described, that the military would flock to the opposition, and that this government would have fallen a long time ago. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, Venezuela, as I said earlier, still produces about 800,000 barrels of oil per day. It still has an income. And then you have to add to that the fact that the Venezuelan government is extraordinarily linked to organized crime. They have linkages backwards and forwards to organized crime in Colombia. They have linkages to the Bolivian cocaine industry. They have linkages across the ocean and throughout the Caribbean through drug trafficking organizations. And, of course, they also have this incredible set of connections with organizations, including what we're now finding information that they're linked, for example, to trafficking organizations in Africa and the Middle East, and even the presence of Hezbollah. And then finally, I think one of the most important things is the fact that the Russians are essentially looking the other way. I think I'm not exactly sure whether the Russians like Maduro, but this is a way to stick it to the United States, right? And but I don't think they like Maduro, given what their economic interests are. They're losing money, and they might even be in favor of change, but they don't want a change that the U.S. is going to dominate. So I think that, you know, that Maduro has all of this support. The final connection there is the trafficking of gold. That is being done with the collaboration of the government of Turkey. So there are a whole series of these networks that are keeping the government of Venezuela afloat. They can pay salaries, you know, they can pay the bureaucrats that are still with the government, and obviously they can maintain that military apparatus that supports them.
Eduardo, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
That's Eduardo Gamarra, professor of political science and founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. We talked to them about the ongoing situation in Venezuela and U.S. involvement in past conflicts in Central and South America. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Facebook is rolling out big design changes, and that could affect the online experience for hundreds of millions of users and shake up the social media landscape along the way. We'll find out what's changing, and you can share your thoughts and your hopes or fears maybe for what's going to change online. Our own Stephanie Elkins joins the show for a look at two African-American women composers whose compositions are getting a new look a century later. We'll hear their stories and some of their music along the way. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We break down kitchen, gadgets, and gear, what we need, what we want, and what's going to just sit around collecting dust. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.